If you want to see examples of what we talked about on the show, check out bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
Two Dimension,
the comic book podcast with no direction.
And we're going to make it clear today, unlike other times.
That's right. We're going to make it clear that we still don't have any direction. Who are you?
I'm Don Moore, and you are?
Dr. Al. And we are here to talk about comic books.
And nothing but comic books.
And Beatles.
No, we're not going to talk about the Beatles.
Okay.
Every time we talk about the Beatles, we start arguing about stuff that we didn't even see when we were, so, no.
Well, you know, when I was a kid, did you ever get the, just as a side note or whatever, when I was a kid, I don't have it here, but I know it's in somewhere here. Did you ever get the Yellow Submarine comic book?
No, but I found it and downloaded it. It was gold key, and
yeah.
That was sweet. It was like 35 cents, and it was like
I bought it
pages.
When I was a kid, yeah.
It's nice.
It is nice.
It's nicely illustrated, nicely put together, and a lot of double-page spreads all through it.
Yeah, I don't know who did the art, but I remember seeing it as a kid in, like, 68 or whenever it was, and it was like, oh, man, Beatles, I got to get it. And I was like, the Beatles made a few appearances in comic books. They were in that, I think they were in a Strange Tales story with The Thing. I remember seeing a story with him wearing a Beatle wig or something like that. They were in a Batman in the early 70s with or late 60s with the Paul is Dead thing or whatever in their Sergeant Pepper gear, and there was a few others. Oh. They did make a few appearances in the books, which is kind of funny actually.
There was in Casper the Friendly Ghost. There was one that was spooky, you know, the guy with the
beard.
Yeah, I remember. And his girlfriend Pearl, they had the red hair and the bow. And the panel starts. She's looking at a magazine, and there's a picture of four guys, you know, it was the Beatles, but it said the Zeetles on it. And she's looking and going, oh. And Spooky walks, oh, God, she's looking at this, and he starts thinking he's going to lose his girl. So he ends up getting a wig and a guitar, and he says, I feel silly, but whatever I can do to keep my girl. And then all of a sudden, this other character is, like, chasing after Spooky all the time. Anyway, it was a one-page strip. The last panel shows Spooky running away from this other ghost that's, you know, after him. And then it shows Pearl looking out the window of the kitchen going, every time I find a nice brownie recipe, Spooky has to go around dressing up like one of those sissies. And I guess the Zeetles was on the other page of the recipe. She's looking at a ladies' magazine.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, Beatles cartoons or Beatles knockoff cartoons were all over pop culture at the time.
Was that book you're talking about from the 60s?
Yeah, it was the 60s.
You know, I'll be honest with you. I seen them. I looked at them. But I can't tell you I've ever read a Harvey book. I know you did, didn't you?
Oh, yeah.
You read the Caspers and all those.
I never
read them, ever.
A lot of times when I was, you know, too young to read, my parents would get those. My brother always got them. My neighbor that read comics, you know, that guy that just got out of the Army, he had a lot of parties.
Yeah.
And a lot of my friends, that was primarily what they had in their collection was Harvey comics.
Wow.
I knew girls that read nothing but Harveys. But everybody had some in their collection.
I never, ever, ever had any.
Well, all it tells me is your childhood really sucked.
No. Yeah, it really did. You know, I was reading the horror stuff, and you know, the even though the Harveys were horror related, it was just like, I don't know. They never grabbed my attention. You know, maybe they were a little too.
Well, they were.
They looked a little wimpy. You
yeah,
know
they were
I mean?
Kind of homogenized in a way. You know,
yeah,
was,
who was the artist on a Warm? I know Cologne, Ernie Cologne did.
Yeah, Ernie Cologne was real successful at it.
Warren Kremer.
Warren Kremer, which again,
one of your favorites.
Yeah, none of these people were ever named. They were never given credit. Somebody posted on one episode you and I talked about Harvey Comics. Somebody came on and gave a comment, mentioned Warren Kremer and some of these other people. And then I found this information, I think it was a Tomorrow's publication, I think it's Comic Book Artists. Mm-hmm. They had a Harvey issue. The reason the Harveys didn't give these people credit was they didn't want the other comic companies taking them, so they didn't want anybody to know. But Warren Kremer was the art director. He did most of the covers for Harvey, which is astronomical in itself. Did a lot of the drawings, and then they had Howie Post.
Howie Post,
did
yeah.
Anthro.
Did he do Anthro? Yeah, for DC.
He did.
Yeah.
Him and Warren Kremer did most of the Hot Stuff stories, but Howie Post did some Richie Rich stories that I absolutely loved. And he was great. One thing about Howie Post that blows my mind was he did Anthro for DC, which is a teenage
caveman.
Yeah. But it was a completely different style than that smooth.
It was more of a realistic style.
Yeah. And then they keep showing, whenever I look his name up, there was I think he had a newspaper comic strip of Anthro, but it was almost like a BC, you know, Johnny Hart type
oh,
style.
Okay.
It wasn't copying Johnny Hart, but it was a simpler style like that. And Howie Post did some other stuff, I think, for DC. He was pretty versatile.
Kremer did work. He did more straightforward work too. I've Chris sworn that I've seen some Charlton Western by him.
Yeah, he did stuff like that. I think he did some of those Black Cat stories for Harvey.
Okay.
I think Warren Kremer did some realistic stuff like Westerns and stuff like that.
No, I shouldn't say that I never got any Harvey, because Harvey did do some superhero stuff. If
yeah,
I remember correctly,
yeah.
Like, yeah, Jack-O-Lantern and Spider-Man and the Piranha and
Jigsaw.
And then in the 60s, I mean, in the 50s, Harvey was like one of the main competitors to EC with all their horror titles, like Chamber of Chills and Tomb of Terror and all that
stuff. I see that stuff.
Which are great.
I see that online. I never saw those in person. The only Harveys I ever saw was...
Yeah, the kiddie ones.
Yeah, the Richie Rich, which is one of my favorites. Casper, Hot Stuff, all that stuff. I never knew Harvey did superheroes. It was a little while in the 60s.
Yeah, it was in the 60s.
And
yeah.
I've seen the horror stuff. And then they even had some Archie titles and Sabrina titles that were had nothing to do with them. They were like DC's House of Mysteries comics.
Okay.
But,
all right.
Yeah, they were comics I love. Rook always finds that amusing. But,
yeah, well, I mean, we've talked about this before, but this is, I think... Well, I don't think it's all Harvey, but it's a lot of Bob Powell stuff at any rate is Harvey, and this book of zombies, one of these Craig Yeo books that I have all
yeah.
whatever. A lot of that stuff is Harvey comics, and they were pretty gruesome.
You know, we talked about those Yeo
yeah.
books before you showed them. I never realized some of those were Harvey stories.
I didn't either until like you go back. Well, with the you know there's a. There's a website called the Digital Comics Museum. You can find all that old
yeah.
stuff on there, and you'll be surprised at the stuff that they were putting out. Alfred Harvey, I guess, was the publisher who put out all that stuff. But then in the 60s, besides the superhero stuff, what they did a little bit, and a few Alarming Adventures, I think, with Kirby. They did some Kirby work for him, too, along with every other company. But then they just settled in with the kids stuff, I think, in the late 60s and
yeah,
70s.
That's what was selling. And when Richie Rich came about, he basically took over the company. They had, I don't know how, it was an astronomical amount of titles, and it was all Richie Rich.
Yeah.
And I guess Richie Rich had more titles than anybody even imagined. And it basically, like, he almost took over the company. And then
Yeah.
I guess it was around the 80s, it all went away. And all
Did
that.
it? I mean, okay, I wasn't sure what the end date was on all that
I'm
stuff.
not positive. I remember reading the book. They stopped running so many. I think Ernie Colon left them.
Yeah,
And,
he was also working for Warren at the same time he
yeah.
was working
And I know he's
for
doing work for Marvel and DC and Epic Illustrated.
and he was an assistant to Wally Wood too,
That makes
along with
sense.
everybody.
That makes sense. I could see that. But and Warren Krimmer wasn't doing as much. And some of the artists that they brought in, I thought were kind of subpar. But that was just me. I still look at it, and it's kind of like what they say about Marvel. After Jack Kirby left in the 70s, it did somewhat of, it was still good, but it did somewhat of a black backslide compared to what it was in the 60s.
Yeah, I think isn't it a lot of companies take a backslide in the 70s, kind of? Some things went in a good direction, but a lot of things went kind of like they're either redundant or just took a turn for the worse or a darker turn or a more whatever. And
It's hard to keep it going, you
I
know.
still love it though.
Yeah, when I say that, there was a lot of books, and we always, oh, we've talked about this before. I think with Dennis, was the Bronze Age. People always talk about the Bronze
I
Age, the
love
Roaring Twenties.
the
Yeah,
Bronze Age.
to me, there
The
was magical
70s? The
times.
70s ruled, man.
There were magical times in them, and I mean, I understand some of the books weren't so great, but I can't think of any time in history of comics where everything was positive, perfectly
No.
good.
I mean, I
So,
technically believe, I think personally the 60s were better, but the 70s, there was like a lot of great art coming in. And in the 70s, we began the influx of new people. The 60s was almost kind of like the old guys still rule, but they're getting towards their, retirement ages and kind of like not as good as they used to be. Whereas the young guys that came out of the fanzine started to take over in the 60s, and it just changed completely, became more adult, maybe darker, maybe more went into taboo areas than the 60s. They were just kind of like they didn't want to get into it or whatever, even though there was always comic books have always skirted with, controversy from like EC and, all that kind of stuff or whatever. But that sells copies. So, but yeah, the 70s are great. The Bronze Age. I mean, God, Wrightson, Kaluta, Jones,
Oh,
Smith,
Simonson,
Simonson,
Chaykin.
Jim Starlin, Chaykin. I mean, among many others. How can you like? It's greatness there. I mean, hell, that's when I bought all most of my comic books in the 60s. I was little kid, so I could only get a couple a week. By the 70s, I was either working or it was comic shops, and I was getting a bunch more stuff. And that's when the comic shops started opening up too.
Yeah, great times. Great
Even
times.
though we've talked about the comic shops kind of ruined it. It helped it and ruined it in a way, because it became more of a hobby than a form of like cheap entertainment.
Yeah, it did, but I don't know.
It's still great.
I don't know if they really would have stuck around if the comic shops weren't
That's
around.
true too,
They could have been gone.
They keep whittling the pool of readers though by not being all over the place. But yeah, that may have been what saved the comic book industry, in a weird way. I've never really read much about it, but I can just only speak from my own, perspective on it or whatever. But anyway.
Yeah, I think you're correct.
All right, man. Well, let's take a break and play some music, and we'll come back and we'll talk about more comic books.
You got it.
Sacrificed to prodigious sun, I am. within the shattered glass to look again. And I killed a man who looks like you. I don't understand the things a man won't do. Yeah, I killed a man who looks like you. I don't understand the things a man won't do.
You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you want to hear our older episodes, you can find them at our blog on bunchofdorks.com.
All right, we're back, and that was our musical interlude by Robert Pollard with I Killed a Man Who Looks Like You. Nice title.
That is a nice title.
It's a good song.
My question is, who is Robert Pollard?
He is the lead singer, main driving force of the band Guided by Voices.
Oh, yeah.
Who's been around since the 90s, and I'm not kidding you, they must have like 10,000 songs out there. He is like, I've never seen a writer like this guy. He writes like hundreds of songs every year, and he puts out most of them on either solo, some Guided by Voices.
So they're still together as that band?
I think he broke them up again. I think they broke up in the middle of it. They were touring, and they were actually going to play in Miami, and he broke the band up, so he's doing solo now. I haven't looked on his website, but that's from like a few years ago. But yeah, that's one of his solo records. He also does collaborations with other artists under different names. And this guy is like, the word prolific is C. Robert Pollard underneath there. So
wow.
Yeah, that's a very good song.
Well, that's something.
He is as prolific in songwriting as Jack Kirby was in comic book.
That's drawing. That's something to see.
Jack Kirby did many, 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 many comic books.
And all unique.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah. You know? I mean, I found a few that he did. Like, again, I found it on Digital Comics Museum, some old stuff. And it was weird. All the companies that he worked for, I mean, Joe Simon would be inking most of them. But every once in a while, you get some strange inker that kind of like, you could tell it's Kirby because the penciling was so strong, but it was just kind of, okay, you know, I guess he did it really quick, and the inker did it really quick, and it was just a 5-page story and a, you know, romance book. So, but
that's always been something that as a kid, Jack Kirby just stood out to me. But on that Kirby book that Mark Evanier put out, he was talking about, you know, inkers was always a touchy spot with a lot of fans. But Jack Kirby never complained. He looked at it, these men had to earn a living for their families, and he didn't want to take it away from them. I guess, to me, as a kid, the only one that really upset me was Vince Coletta a lot of times on Kirby.
Yeah.
And Joe Sinnott made me extremely happy when I saw his.
Yeah.
The rest of them, I don't know. I mean, I like some better than
Chick
others.
Stone.
Yeah, well, because of you, I've really become a huge Chick Stone fan. That I used to test that to Joe Sinnott. I didn't realize that.
Chick Stone did a few of those?
Yeah, well, you know, when I grew up, I was always see the reprints that Joe Sinnott did, and I just assumed Joe Sinnott did everything past three.
No.
And I know George Russo's did the first one, you know, which is kind of funny.
Dick Ayers, George Russo's,
yeah, Dick
Paul
Ayers
Ryan
did a really good job on Jack Kirby, I thought.
He did. Paul Reinman and George Russo,
But I'm going to look at it now, and I'm thinking, you know, it is kind of surprising some of the inking choices they made. Frank Giacquoia, who I knew as Frank Garcia.
Saul Brodsky did a few of them. Yeah. Frank Garcia,
But Frank Giacquia, I really liked on Jack Kirby a lot.
He was good. He was a great artist.
And John Perputin. I think we both agree.
He was really good,
On Jack Kirby.
Who was the main production guy.
Did John Perputin ink anybody else?
Yeah, he sure did. He inked with Buscema, I know that much. Yeah. He might have even inked the Gene Colan story or two, but definitely Buscema. He was really good, and he was the guy responsible for all the deadlines, I think, at Marvel back in that real young, too.
Yeah. Yeah,
like in his 40s or whatever.
That was in that book, Marvel Untold Stories. It was kind
Yeah. He's an unsung hero of that era.
He's
definitely.
Sometimes on the letters pages, you'd see his name. It was always kind of a joke.
Big John, right?
Yeah, they'd always say John Verputin. And you always see references made. It was, to me, kind of fun, loving references, but I didn't really realize he's a real person. I thought they made him up.
Oh, no.
There was nobody with a name like that in Oklahoma, so I just thought...
Well, Irving Forbush was a made-up person.
Yeah, Irving Forbush is the other one that, you know, was... so, me, Irving
Forbush... Or
Forbush
Man. Remember Forbush Man?
Right? I'd hear reference. I didn't really know. What was it?
Forbush Man?
Hmm.
That was in the... Remember that Marvel comedy book they did of Not Brand Eck?
Yeah.
He was a goofy little superhero. He wore like a pot on his head with two eyeball holes, and he had like long johns and a cape. Or
like
whatever.
The Red Tornado with.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, that was like one of their humorous books or whatever before, like Crazy and Spoof and all these other, you know, things that they were doing or whatever. I actually liked Not Brand Act. They had a Kirby Ditto humor story. Sutton did a few. There was a lot of them actually. I remember buying them when I was a kid. Oh yeah.
Well. I walked in here, and there's no boundaries to me. I walked into Al's place, and I just immediately start seeing things in a pile and start pulling them out. We talked about it before, but I was kind of happy to see Al's got the fourth issue of Weird Love from Yo Books and IDW.
Yo.
And the cover...
Matt Baker.
Really gets me. And when
Matt
I look
Baker,
at this cover,
yeah. Greatness.
The finishes doesn't make me think of, but the way it's drawn and the composition makes me think of Dave Stevens. Or Frank.
People have said that Baker was the original Dave Stevens because he did Beautiful Women back in the day.
Boy, that's an understatement. This drawing right here, the composition, this will be on the blog, but that right there is strong. But the first thing I see is Dave Stevens, if Jim Steranko inked him.
Yeah.
And it's the composition, everything is good. But it also reminds me a little bit of Frazetta.
He's another artist who died young. He was 40 when he died. He was one of the first African American artists in comics too.
Are you serious?
For real, yeah. We talked about it before. Matt Baker, yeah. He was an African American artist. He did Sheena. Did he do Sheena? Oh God, I know he did Sky Girl. He may have done Sheena. I'm not 100% sure, but he specialized. No, Phantom Lady is what he did. That was his big one. He specialized in good girl art. And for the Iger Studios and stuff like that, and he was one of the first African American artists in comic books. And
I don't remember us talking about him.
And he had kind of a, you know, in the 40s, everybody was starting out and they were young, but his style developed in the 50s into this freaking beautiful Dave Stevens like pre Dave Stevens like. Almost like in some instances it reminded me a little bit of Dave Stevens inked by not that one. By Bill Everett, you know, it had this weird, it was beautiful, you know, he did a lot of romance books or whatever, you know, but I think he did a few things for Atlas Comics, but he died when he was 40, and towards the end, I think he was actually working as assistant to Vince Coletta, so, you know, and I think even Vince inked some of his last thing, some of his later work, and it wasn't really good, but when Baker would ink it all himself, it was fantastic, man. We'll put examples of his work. He was a beautiful, beautiful
I'll
artist.
Tell you, I can't say enough about it. I, Matt Baker, you're something else. I'm sorry you died so young. But
39, 40. Heart condition.
I'm glad they're publishing your work.
And he was like a real, like, I should get his book, but I haven't. There's a book about him. And he was like a real stylish dude. Like, there's pictures of him, like, he's all dressed up, like some hep cat from the 50s and 40s. Yeah. And he was like, you know, he was a comic book artist, and he was, you know, like a party or whatever, but...
That's why we keep comparing it to Dave Stevens. That's why I was talking about Dave Stevens as a really nice dresser, which is something...
I
wonder if Dave Stevens is
stylish. That's what I was thinking.
Away, from Matt Baker.
That's what I was thinking, you know? I mean, I've never read many Dave Stevens interviews. I've never heard him talk about Matt Baker, but when you think about it, you know, they were similar type dudes. You know, they were like, you know, a lot of ladies, men, dress up, you know, look all stylish and all that, and both died young. Oddly enough, even though Stevens, I think, died in his 40s, died in his 50s maybe his late 40s, but they both died young, there is a strange connection there. You know, they were both beautiful, beautiful artists, man. And Dave Stevens always harkened back to the 50s, you know, with Betty Page and,
yeah,
you know, all that stuff. And then Matt Baker, I don't know specifically which one, but there's books that he draws where I know he's got some Betty Page-ish looking, you know, ladies in them. So, yeah, oh, man. Oh, my God, Matt Baker's.
Well, there's
got
to be an influence from it.
Matt Baker is so great. Anyway, getting back to the book, you're looking at a story called Too Fat to Frug. Yes, that's a Charlton. It looks like some Charlton greatness from the 60s.
It says an unknown artist, Gary Friedrich, who is behind Ghost Rider for Marvel.
It says unknown artist?
Yeah, artist unknown.
Well, let me take a look at it. I could have sworn it was Norman Nodell, Donald Norman. I mean, it looks like his work, but you know what? I could be wrong. Some of these panels look like his work. Huh. But, you know, I don't know. I've been wrong before. And,
well, it could be him, and they just weren't sure.
It's a funny story, though.
Yeah, it's...
It looks like Donald Norman. It really does.
It starts out with a three-piece band that looks a lot like the Beatles.
Yeah.
I guess this is when the Beatles were starting out and were huge.
What year is that? Did it say the year?
1967.
Okay.
The Beatles didn't look like that anymore.
No, they didn't. But there were a few bands that looked like that.
But it's about an overweight girl that's in love with somebody. It's kind of neat.
I miss those books.
No, you don't have to. They're coming out now.
They're coming out now, yeah. I mean, yeah. And the reprint is really good, actually. You know, I mean, it's not as good as the original. But I remember seeing reprints in the 70s of old comics. And it definitely perfected a way of making them look pretty close to what they're supposed to look like. But yeah, these are all public domain stories, but they're really doing us a favor by putting them out because they're hilarious. That's Bob Powell.
Yeah,
another one of the great artists of the
where
time.
The story is called Men You Shouldn't Marry, and it has these things where the woman's in the car with the guy out on Lookout Point, and he's throwing a bottle of alcohol over like he's drunk, and the girl's looking side dejected. Another one, the girl's looking through the bushes, and her, I guess the guy she's with is kissing another woman at a party. And another woman standing there, or standing behind her boyfriend while he's gambling everything away. Another one, the guy's abusing her, he's yelling at her, she's crying. You shouldn't marry these kind of men. Stay away from them.
No, yeah, that's better said than done.
It says artist unknown.
No, the next story, the one after that, is by Bob Powell.
Oh, pardon me, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that one. That's,
oh,
by
that's
Bob
just one
Powell.
Page.
Okay, who did tons of work.
I was a border racket girl.
Oh, yeah. Who's the publisher on that?
Fawcett.
Fawcett, okay. Yeah, Bob Powell did, like, oh, man. I think every time I look online on the Digital Comics Museum, like, there's a Bob Powell story in almost every book.
Yeah, you're a huge Bob Powell.
Oh, yeah. He had a lot of assistants, but he has such a nice style. His characters have such a nice flow and a movement and a gesturing or whatever that you can always tell, you know, that's Bob Powell. And like I said, he's you know, ubiquitous. He's everywhere in the 50s. Not so much in the 60s, but definitely in the 40s and 50s. And was Sheena.
One thing, when you see these guys, he's the one that George Tuska...
He's the one that George Tuska belted.
Because he was he was, you know, talking lewd about that woman that worked in the office.
Oh, yeah, now you're killing me. I can't remember her name now, but yeah. The one woman that worked for the Iger studio,
And George Tuska took Bob Powell out.
Yeah, he took him out,
Powell, you're a great artist, but if I believe any of the book, you're a little mouthy guy. I don't like you.
Yeah, well, you know, it was supposedly like a bit of a... whatever was Sikowski, apparently. He was a little bit of a...
Really?
Yeah. Not to mention he might have been the fastest artist of them all. Because apparently he could do like 6-7 pages a day.
Wow.
Yeah, but Sikowski apparently was a little bit of, a little bit of a... I don't know. There's stories about him. I'm not going to badmouth him, but I've read stories about him where not in the best light.
Yeah.
But prolific artist as well, you know.
Yeah, there was somebody I liked when I was a kid.
There was a story about him where, like, they would give him a script and he'd have the story done in like a week, and the editor would say, "Hey, Mike, you know, your quality's going down. You need to slow it down a little bit. You know, maybe take like 2 or 3 weeks to do it." And Sikowski would go like, "Yeah, okay." So Sikowski take the script, draw the story in a week, leave it for another 2 weeks, and then bring it back to the editor and go, "Here's the story." And the editor goes, "See? See, you took your time and you did a much better story. See what it is? Oh, yeah, there you go. Yeah, that's one way to show off, you know, whatever. But yeah, apparently one of the fastest guys."
You know, Mike Sikowski, I liked his work, but sometimes it did look kind of rushed and sloppy, like he was only putting down what he had to put down.
Sometimes.
But I did like him.
I liked him in the 60s, even though he did some covers for the Justice League where he made, like, some of the characters look kind of overweight or whatever, and I don't think on purpose either. Like, there's one Justice League cover, I remember Batman looked kind of like Fat Man.
Yeah, well, they always had a kind of a thick midsection.
Yeah, yeah.
And Kurt Swan did the same thing.
He did, too, yeah. A little skinny legs and a big torso or whatever. Yeah,
yeah. Well, the big midsection, their torso wasn't quite as big, which, I don't know, you can't help if you draw. Your drawings tend to take on your personality trait somewhat. I mean, not
your
always.
Age, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, they see that kind of a thing, and, you know, they're getting to be older men, and I think that's what was happening. I say that some of them, I've seen some cartoonists that are, you know, overweight guys that draw these fantastically fit muscle guys.
Yeah, there you go.
They're probably impossible to be like, but most of the time, your drawings tend to take on your traits. And I think Kurt Swan and Mike Sikowski, I always saw that in both of them. And when I say that, I love some of those stories, but they did have that to them.
That middle-aged paunch feel to them.
Yeah, yeah.
and not only was it funny you mentioned it, not only did Kurt Swan draw him with like a little, you know, big mix section, but he also had a receding hairline too for a bunch of years. So it was definitely Superman, you know, hitting the 40s or whatever.
You know, Bill Everett, I like Bill Everett.
Oh,
a lot.
Bill Everett's a lot of times, artistic greatness.
He is, but in the 60s and early 70s, when he drew the Submariner story, the Dr. Strange, it seemed to me like everybody, including the women, had high foreheads.
Yeah.
Like a bit of a receding hairline. And a lot of times they had a high forehead with a widow, with that little widow.
The widow's peak. Well, Dr. Strange definitely did.
But yeah. I'm thinking, is he drawing Frankenstein? You know, even the women, like, what was that woman on? All of them. He always had a lady, and they always had their hair brushed straight back, high forehead. It looked like Natasha on Bullwinkle and Rocky.
Yeah, there you go, yeah. But his work in the 50s was amazing.
Well, even the work I'm talking about, I really loved.
It was amazing.
He was a great one. But
He's another one that died in his early 50s. Yeah, he was a bit of a drunk, I think, you know, but yeah. Yeah, I mean, he did some nice Submariners in the 70s too.
Yeah.
Later 70s for the regular book, for the Submariner book. I mean,
he's the creator of Submariner.
Yeah, right. Sure.
So he left and then came back later and was doing it again.
Yeah, he was freelancing. Yeah, he left. A lot of these guys, I think, left comics in the 50s after the EC thing, and then they came back little by little.
And he drew a lot more sophisticated. It's almost a different style than what he had in the early days.
Yeah. When he was doing Submariner, again, all these artists were starting out in the 40s, except for a few that were more polished. But in the 50s is when their style really, like, took off and became, you know, like, oh, yeah, I can tell that's Jack Kirby, or you'd always thought it was Jack Kirby, but yeah, look at Everett, you know, it's like, wow, that's completely different from the scratchy, beautiful, the scratchy stuff in Marvel and Fantasy Masterpieces, early Submariners and all that stuff. Yeah, definitely with him. He was also a good girl artist, too, was at least more so in the 50s, anyway, before the Widow's Peak in the 50s in the romance books and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, Everett's like amazing, you know, no doubt about it. Yeah, that's a cool book. There's only been four issues so far. Yeah. That's a cool book.
The next story, it says Two-Faced Woman.
I don't think. He thinks Pete Costanza did it, right?
Yeah, well, I was going to say, it says here, art possibly by Pete Costanza.
We did a lot of DC Superman family stuff, didn't he?
Yeah, I think so.
Marvel, Captain Marvel, right? So
yeah, Pete Costanza, I think, was a letterer. I think I mostly knew him as a letterer.
But I think he did some stuff for
The Captain Marvel stuff in Fawcett he did.
Yeah.
He did that cover I love so much where Captain Marvel and Billy Batson are standing on that mountain.
Yeah.
But I think he did lettering. And
he might have.
And I think he did a lot of Bugs Bunny stuff.
He did? Okay. I
may be getting confused with somebody else.
Yeah, Yeah, I'll have to look it up, but yeah, I just remember from, like, Shazam.
But I will say this, and I'm looking at this artwork right here. It's from the American Comics Group, but what I see, except for the inking, I see Kurt Scaffenberger.
Well, they both had a similar style.
Yeah, because I thought Kurt Scaffenberger did that cover that, you know, Pete Costanza did, but this, to me, it looks like Kurt Scaffenberger or somebody else inked him. I mean, the faces, the way he put the people together.
Yeah, Pete Costanza, I'm looking at it right now. American comic book artist and illustrator is best known for his work on Fawcett's Captain Marvel and Marvel Family during World War II. Yeah. Began his career as T.C. Beck's chief's assistant. Yeah. He might have done lettering, but I do remember him more for...
I might be confusing with somebody else.
Okay.
I do that all the time. No, this story is actually... It doesn't say who wrote it. But it's...
He did a lot of Jimmy Olsen. That's what he did. He did a lot of Jimmy Olsen books. That's probably why you're getting... You're connecting him with Schaffenberger. Because Schaffenberger would do the Lois Lane books.
Well, yeah, he did a lot of the Lois Lane. And he did some Jimmy Olsen's too, which...
Yeah, apparently he retired from comics because he had a stroke. And then it affected his drawing hand, but he taught himself to oil paint left-handed and produced over 400 paintings of adventure romance, many of Americana, which have been exhibited and sold. So pretty cool. I'll have to find some of Pete Costanza's paintings. I didn't know he did any of that. Pretty neat, actually. You know, Frazetta did that, too. Did you know that? He had a stroke towards the end of his life, which affected his painting, his right hand. He taught himself to paint left-handed.
You always talked about that.
Not as great, but, I mean, pretty freaking amazing that he was able to do that. That's just will. That's a that's force.
I never knew that. I just knew with Frazetta that I saw a picture of Mike Allred when he was doing Mad Men.
Yeah.
Mad Men. He always had the back cover was always drawn by a guest artist. You know, Mike Mignola. And one of them he had Frazetta. It looked like it's from a sketch that he colored. In the letters page, it had a picture of him at a convention standing there, and the foreground was Frank Frazetta. I didn't know it was Frazetta. It looked like something Al Capp would have drawn, because he had one big eye on one side. And
yeah, that was a stroke.
Kind of looked like Two-Face from Batman. And the caption said, you know, I'm trying my hardest to gather the courage to go talk to Frank Frazetta. Well, rightly so, you know, I mean.
Sure, yeah.
By that time, Frank Frazetta wasn't a human being anymore. He was like a legend that, you know, he just couldn't live up to. And I was talking to my friend Brett. I said, I saw that picture. Oh, yeah, he's had a tough time. It was the stroke then.
Oh, okay.
I guess that was really severe. But we're talking about this book. What got me, the cover we're talking about, Matt Baker. And the cover says, Trailer Trash Girl. And inside, the story says Flirtation on Wheels, and it's drawn by Rick Estrada.
Rick Estrada, yeah.
Which I have to say...
I never knew it was a 50s artist.
This is a staggering story. I mean, I haven't read it, but just looking at it, doesn't say who wrote it. It's from Teenage Temptations. But this one, and also the guy in the front, I just forgot his name, the one that did Sheena.
Matt Baker?
No, not Matt Baker,
Bob Powell.
Bob Powell and this guy has a really heavy Milton Caniff looking style.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I guess a lot of guys in the 50s...
Toast had Milton Caniff style before he revamped it.
Exactly. And but, I mean, just how they placed the characters...
And the blacks, spotting the blacks and stuff like
that. But this has got really strong lines, but I look through here, it's just nothing but fantastic. Just not even reading the story, just looking at the artwork. And even though it's just people conversing... It's a dynamic story. Everybody's moving around. You said Rick Estrada. You talked about him a bit.
Cuban. Yeah, born in Cuba, came to the U.S. I think he went to art school here. Or maybe he didn't. He was already good enough to get work. But he went to New York and he got a job in comics. But his style changed dramatically in the 60s. I mean, that 50s stuff, like you said, looks really like Caniff.
Yeah.
When I first was knowing of his work, his style was really loose and almost like, you remember how Jerry Granadetti style was? It was a combination of like a little bit of Granadetti and maybe a little bit of Toth or whatever. It wasn't as appealing as this stuff is.
Well, you know, this one, it seemed like he has his own style and vision, like his own idea. He stands out. The work he did later, some of the work I've seen, it's good.
It is good. Yeah,
it's
I like
not,
it.
I don't know. It's kind of like, compared to this, it's generic. Like he was just trying not to stand out or just, you know. And when I say this, I hate to say it, but it's also like a, I think I made his name. They used to draw Iron Man.
Tuska?
No, not Tuska.
Johnny Craig?
No, Iron Man from Marvel. What was the name? I used to dislike him.
Who did I? God, there's a lot of guys who did Iron Man. But...
He did, I think, Godzilla.
Oh, you mean Trimpy?
Not Herb Trimpy. Yeah, I still dislike him. what's the guy's name?
Who did Godzilla?
He did Iron Man in the 60s, I think after Steve Ditko.
I don't know, man. I'll have to, you know. Anyway.
Don Heck.
Oh, Don, huh? Really? Don you didn't like Don Heck?
I didn't when I was growing up, but then when I started seeing those old Iron Man stories from the 60s,
yeah,
they were something.
They're strong.
But his later work, he was basically just taking whatever he could get. And
he was an older man.
Yeah, he was, but like I said, that's the same thing. It's like that older work, it always looked to me like he was wanting to draw a drama strip in the newspaper comics or a romance strip.
Which he should have been.
Yeah, he didn't. I don't know. I always see him. It's like he just didn't like what he was stuck with doing all the time. And he was in that Marvel Comics The Untold Story. They made a joke that I guess nobody wanted to do. I don't know if it's Shogun Warriors or the Godzilla book. Nobody wanted it, and he was always in the office trying to get in and get good. And that was always a joke people had. But to me, his work in the 70s was always kind of uninspired and just basic, you know. But when I look back and see those old stories, what happened? And to me, Rick Estrada never slid that bad, but I'm looking at this, and all I think is, Rick Estrada, man, what happened? He could have been considered Frazetta, you know, or, you know, Alex Toth.
You know, a lot of these guys, the older they get, they simplify their style, or they become, like, more stylistic, and then they kind of, like, you know, I mean, he worked. Estrada got work throughout the 60s and even in the 70s. I don't know if he got a lot of work, but he got work. But definitely, like, that is heads and tails better than the stuff that he did in the 70s. I still like the stuff that Don Heck did in the 70s. I just think the times changed, and he didn't.
Yeah,
you know?
And that could be, too. But, I mean, I look at the stuff, and it's subpar compared to that early 60s work he was doing.
Well, I mean, if you want to go there, not in that strong of a sense, but I kind of think some of the stuff that Kirby did in the later 70s is subpar to the 60s stuff.
Yeah, I still love the stuff he did, but yeah, it was his best work was behind him.
Yeah.
And then when the 80s came on, it was really so
there's fun. Still, you see still flashes of greatness in the 70s and 80s, definitely in the 70s and a little bit in the 80s. But you can see his health was failing him, and it wasn't the same.
Yeah,
you know?
With the 80s. I remember in the mid-80s when he was doing the New Gods for DC again when he finished up the Hunger Gods and all that.
Underdogs, yeah.
And then when he did, what was it, Superpowers, whatever it was.
Yeah.
That was subpar work.
Some of it was good, though. I think I don't know if he needed better anchors on his work, you know. There was, like, guys that, great guys and great technicians, but they didn't add anything to the... You know, to the Kirby, you know, power or whatever.
But you know, the covers he did for Marvel, I thought were a lot of times unforgivable. You know,
in the
70s? Yeah, when he came back. I mean, he did Fantastic Four covers. He did Avengers covers. Some of the Captain America covers were still strong. Some of them I really loved deeply. But the other ones, there was an Avengers cover and a Fantastic Four covers that looked like he basically just kind of had a thumbnail sketch, kind of quickly drew it out, and then just somebody slapped ink on it. It didn't look like he was getting any direction on, you need to do this for the cover or that. From understanding Mark Evanier's book, that when he was with Marvel, he wasn't really a cover guy. He wasn't interested in covers. And they said that,
He did all the FF covers.
Yeah, he did all the stuff he did the covers. But they said John Romita kind of laid the covers out, and Jack Kirby, you know, drew it from the layout.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Then Mark Evanier said when he went to D.C., he says more than likely Carmine Infantino was laying the cover out. I mean, just, you know, he probably had a thumbnail, says put this on there.
Oh, okay.
And then Jack Kirby drew the cover himself. He didn't trace it. But I was thinking, and somebody brought up, and I kind of tend to agree with it, Neil Adams. His covers for DC in the 60s and 70s are a lot different than the covers he did for Marvel. And I think what I understood was that Carmen Infantino was laying everything out for all the covers DC put out. I mean, just giving a thumbnail, and the artists were following them.
Okay.
I don't know if Nick Hardy had to do that. But,
I don't know about him. He did tons of them.
But Neil Adams' covers for Marvel was completely different than the stuff he did for DC. I mean, you can see he drew them.
But what you're intimating is that when Kirby went back to Marvel, he didn't have somebody telling him how to draw the cover. He would just do whatever popped into his head, which may not have been. But then again, you see other drawings that he's done, which are very dynamic, you know?
Well, Mark Evanier said he was never interested in covers. He's interested in telling stories.
Telling stories, yeah. Makes sense in the world.
But, you know, that's why he left Marvel. He was wanting to write and draw his own stories. He was getting tired of the fact that Stan Lee, I think what Stan Lee was doing was adding to it was nothing but help. But Stan Lee was getting editor credit, and pay, and writing credit and pay. And he was getting upset that they wouldn't let him write and draw his own stuff. And then Jim Steranko comes off the streets, and he was a writer-artist.
That's
so
true.
So when Jack Kirby came back, when
That's
he went
true.
To D.C., when he came back to Marvel, everything he said was said created, written, and drawn by Jack Kirby. And I think basically he was hands-off, and I think some of that was a mistake. I mean,
he came back to Marvel, what, 74, 75?
I think it was 75.
And he left like in 78 or something, 79. He was only there for a few years. And he went off to animation after that.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I know he's doing Eternals and Devil Dinosaur, Captain America, and Black Panther. And
2001. Eternals.
Yeah, Eternals. I love that.
Yeah, that was a great book.
But even those, they're subpar of the work in the 60s, but they're still good.
Oh, yeah.
And and he was writing them, and the Black Panther stories, I was really excited every time I bought one. I'd read the book, I'd think, why am I buying these? But I look at them, they're just nothing but flashes of awesome. But it's just, I don't know, at the time, for some reason, even 2001, I'd buy those books, and why am I getting these? They're not always so great. But there were times, like when he had the two issues with Marok, those were strong. And then when he had the issues with Machine Man at the end, those were strong. Oh, he also did Machine Man for Marvel.
That's right, Machine Man, yeah. Didn't he create Machine Man?
Yeah, from 2001. And I think Steve Ditko did some of the stories too.
I can't think of any right now, but there probably is one. Can you think of any artist that started out maybe in the 50s? Whose work actually got better in the 70s. I mean, Gene Colan's work was always great.
Yeah.
But then again, he had Tom Palmer ink in his work. So that helped him out a whole hell of a lot, you know. But his stuff in the 70s was just as strong, I think, as the 60s stuff. Even some of the 50s stuff, you know. Buscema was still good, you know, even though he became more of the stock characters or whatever, what I mean? But Buscema's work in the 50s, with late 50s, real nice, and I think even his work in the 70s, personal opinion, when he inked it, was really nice. So there was a few guys that kept it going or whatever, even through the 80s.
Well, you always talked about you liked Buscema better when he inked his own work, and I was saying, I can't remember any of those. But then I started thinking the Tarzan work he did for Marvel.
Nice. Some of them, anyway.
I like that. I did like his Tarzan work, and I think he inked some of that.
Know what I would have loved to have seen ink Kirby, but I don't think he ever did, was Tom Palmer. Do you remember Tom Palmer inking any Jack Kirby art? You know, that was a missed opportunity. Maybe it wouldn't have been that great, but I would have liked to have seen it, you know? I mean, they were both working at Marvel at the same time. I guess it never really, you know. I know, but he definitely inked Ditko, I'm sure he inked almost everybody else. Buscema, yeah, definitely. Ditko, I'm pretty sure he did something. Maybe not. I don't know. It might have done something.
He might have done something.
But definitely Buscema and definitely Colan, obviously. And those guys were from the 50s. They were Golden Age artists. Yeah. I mean, Kirby started in the early 40s. Kirby had 10 years on those guys. But you know, even to the end, Gene Colan was still doing great artwork. I've seen like beautiful like pencil pieces that he was doing in the 2000s. You know, he was an amazing artist.
He was,
guy.
But there were some times where, like when he went to DC and was doing Batman, I was really wanting to like it.
I like it.
Because by this time, I don't know, I was always looking at it, the DC wasn't letting the artists do much with the characters. You know, Superman and Batman, you know, and they had them on the show. I remember they brought Vicki Vale back, and I thought it was kind of interesting, but I don't know. It wasn't as strong as, like, his old Doctor Strange work, and, you know.
It was different. I think his work fit for Batman. I mean,
it
God.
Did fit for Batman.
I still liked it.
But there was times, like the Nathaniel Dusk work, I thought was head over heels far better than the Batman work.
Yeah, he did a lot of nice stuff. Ragamuffins was another little thing. They did for Eclipse, which was real nice.
So sometimes I think it depends on what he was drawing. Like, maybe he just didn't want to draw Batman. You know, I think that it is sometimes that these guys were getting work they could get, and they just weren't really interested in doing it.
Well, after he got, you know, unceremoniously... You know, let go from Marvel. DC just scooped him up and said, "Here's Batman." You know, I mean, you know, the guy who was on Batman before him, Don Newton, was no slouch either. You know, I mean, those were really nice stories.
Didn't he draw Nightforce, Gene Colan?
Nightforce was really good. That's kind of his like Dracula kind of book. You know, seeing he did draw Nightforce. Yeah, he suffered from like some not so great inkers. On DC, a lot of them were good. There was some that didn't really match or whatever. There was something called Silverhawk he did, and it was inked by Steve Mitchell. Steve Mitchell's a good inker, but it just didn't jive with Gene Colan.
Well, sometimes I've heard some, there's another podcast, which I don't agree with. Terry Austin, when he inked Frank Miller, you know,
I liked it.
I loved it. And these guys are carrying on about what they didn't like about it. Well, I see, you know, what they mean. But I really liked it.
Yeah,
I never
I
would
like
have thought
it.
Terry Austin would be a good inker for Frank
Miller. No.
I couldn't see Terry Austin inking Gene Colan. But maybe it would have been okay.
He definitely inked Alex Toth. I've seen that one before. I don't know about Gene. I don't think he ever inked Gene Colan.
It seemed to me,
and that's a lost art because there's no hardly any more pencilers and inkers anymore in comic books.
But you know, Gene Colan was always the type of artist that needed somebody like Tom Palmer, kind of a looser, you know. Type inker. I know Dick Giordano inked Gene Colan.
Yeah, for Batman.
And I like Dick
like
Giordano
him,
a lot. He's one of my favorites, but I don't know. He tended to...
Klaus Janson was a good anchor.
Yeah, for Gene Colan.
He was a good anchor for Gene Colan, yeah. I found the romance, so I'll show it to you like later. It was like an old... Oh, here it is. It was in one of these girls' romances books or whatever by Gene Colan where he inks his own work, and it was tremendous in the 60s. It was like, oh my God, why wasn't this guy inking more work? Well, probably because he was faster just penciling it or whatever, you know? Which is the reason why back then there were inkers, because it was just faster. Mm-hmm. And the wash work that Colan did for Warren was amazing. He did a lot of these creepy and eerie stories in the 60s, which were amazing.
Yeah, I've seen those. And yeah, he was more of a wash type artist. You know?
So, I mean, did you bring any books you wanted to talk about?
Oh, yeah, I did, but the conversation is flowing.
The conversation is flowing, but I think we've come to to your segment here.
Well,
Oh, you got that. I didn't know that.
Al's talked about this before, She-Hulk. From Marvel, it's drawn by Pulido. What's that guy's name?
Javier Pulido.
Yeah, Javier Pulido. Now, when Al talked about it, I think you got one or two issues.
I've got a few of them. Yeah. I've got almost all of them.
But I found this. We were at a bookstore that had old comics for a dollar.
Wilson's.
Yeah, Wilson's. And this was in there. I picked it up.
Okay.
The reason I got it was I really liked the cover. No, I don't know who did it.
I don't know.
But it looks kind of like a...
It does have a name here, but it's cut off.
Yeah. It looks kind of like what's in the interiors, but instead of line work, it looks like it's a...
Watercolor.
Yeah, watercolor, but it's a flat type watercolor. Like, it's still flat graphics, but it's Ant-Man, I think Hellcat, and She-Hulk on the cover.
Yep, that's it.
And they're all small. You know, it shows grass and plants and stuff, and they're giant. that story was great fun. Who was the writer, Al?
The writer is... Charles Sewell.
And Javier Pulido is the artist?
Yes.
And is there an inker with this? Or is he the...
No inker. It's inking. Lost art these days.
Well, I'll tell you, I like the artwork on it.
It is good. It's always been... He's great. He's really good.
She-Hulk's an attorney. And basically, these people are... I don't know who the partner is on this, but Hellcats were there. And they basically have this shrinking technology.
Mm-hmm.
And what the deal is they're trying to shrink it, like shipping. It's going to revolutionize everything. You can buy a whole stock of things, shrink it down, you know, put it in a little box and ship it, and then bring it back to the normal size. Well, that's kind of neat. And then, you know, She-Hulk says, well, Pym Particles does that. You know, Hank Pym, the Ant-Man. And then they say, Pym Particles are too expensive. And anyway... his partner's disappeared. He has everything in a flash drive. And so he can't sell the technology. The partner didn't want to sell the technology to whoever it was, but it was a lot of money. So anyway, it all ensues, and She-Hulk thought they were hiring her as an attorney because she's on retainer for him. Come to find out, they wanted to be She-Hulk and go get him. Anyways, her and Hellcat, and then Hank Pym shows up as the Ant-Man, and he's, I'm not going to give the story away, but they shrink down. All these things happen. He's explaining to them, when you're small, you have to be careful because a hawk can come, you know, a bird can come and snatch you out, all kinds of obstacles. And I found I really enjoyed this single issue. It was a clever story. I bought it for the artwork. I bought it for the cover. And all that's fantastic. But the story was fun and unique. It's not just the typical story that I've read since I was a kid. It was great fun.
It is. It's a good book.
A good book. So I recommend it. It's kind of odd. I'm reading a lot of Marvel comics these days. I'm surprised.
Well, good. You know, a good comic book is a good comic book, depending on it. It doesn't matter who published it.
And the next one is a book that I picked up when I was visiting my daughter in South Carolina. It's called Jim Henson's The Storyteller.
Oh, okay.
And it says underneath it, Witches. And this is the second issue. The cover caught me. It's a Japanese style. It's a woman walking around in the snow, and the comic is sideways. The cover and everything else, it's all printed, you know, panoramic sideways. And
it's a pretty book.
It's basically a Japanese folktale.
Oh,
it tells a story about this guy that runs into a witch. He makes a promise to her, and survives. I guess there's a story about, I can't remember what they called her. Snow Witch or whatever, and it's pretty unique. And then I guess at one point she lets the guy go as long as he swears never to tell anybody about their meeting. And then later on, he meets a girl in the village, you know, that came from somewhere else. You know, she stayed with him. They had a kid, and life went on. I'm not gonna tell you any more about it, but it's written and illustrated by Kyla Vanderklip.
It's really good.
And it is really good. It's by Arkea.
Yeah, it's Boom Studios.
Yeah.
It's a subsidiary, I guess. It looks like it anyway, because it says it's a division of Boom Studios.
I'll tell you, I enjoyed this book immensely.
Is it a one-shot?
Well, it's this is number two.
Oh, okay. Well, it's not a one-shot then.
It's Tale 2 of 4, but this is the only story she did. The story that came before is by somebody else. And the next one, they just said, it's going to be Phantom Isle by Matthew Dow Smith, which it looks nice as well. You know, it was really good.
So you highly recommend it?
Yeah, I highly recommend the second one. I haven't read the others, but they look good as well.
All right, man. That it?
Yeah, I think I'm going to hold it there.
You think you're going to hold it there? All right, well, then I guess that's it for this episode in our ongoing series of comic book discussions.
Sorry, it's been so long. A lot of things happened. It was out of everybody's control.
Holidays.
Well, yeah, now it's the holidays. Hopefully the next episode we'll all be back together again, or most of us.
Or most of us, or, you know.
Or maybe none of us.
Or maybe none of us. Or maybe it'll be a repeat episode. Or maybe it'll be just me just talking, you know.
Have you ever done that? Have you ever done one by yourself?
Yeah, the first one.
Yeah, that's right. See, I guess what I was
wouldn't
seeing,
do one again, though. I wouldn't do one by myself.
Mel, from the Bunch of Dorks. You know, there was four Bunch of Dorks, the original podcast. And then it went down to three and one rotating member. But Mel was really serious about keeping them going, and there was way back, there was one episode where nobody could get together, so he did an episode by himself. And I listened to it, and I thought, oh, God, I can't look away. And people at work were like, well, I guess he was drinking when he was doing the episode.
Oh, no.
And he starts off, and he's talking about this and that, and then the episode starts in him. Where did I go wrong? I had such promise when I was younger.
Oh,
it's
no.
all gone, you know, it's stuff like that. And
oh,
I mean,
no.
I'm kind of exaggerating a bit, but that's kind of, you know, it just went on and on. I'm thinking, I can't listen to this. And then it was a running joke because he did a few of them. Like I said, he was really serious about keeping it going. And every time he'd say he was by himself, he says, I just heard Don click the show off. You know? But no, they, you know, I guess he just decided he wouldn't have beer when he did a show by himself. And it was okay.
God, no, just coffee when we do the show. No
yeah,
beer.
Well.
Oh, well.
So, anyway, if you do a podcast on your own, try not to have beer when you're doing it by yourself.
Yeah.
Words to live by.
Do coffee.
So anyway, I guess that's all I got. Do you have anything else to
that's
add?
That's all for me.
Anyway, it's good to see you again, buddy. And
that's right.
Thanks for listening, everyone. And in the meantime,
read more comics.